Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. I'm your reader, Trila Glenn. Two stories on the front page today about longtime prominent leaders in the area stepping down. The first, Stanley wraps up a long career at Iowa Western. After guiding Iowa Western Community College's training program for more than a quarter of a century, Mark Stanley of Glenwood is stepping down. Stanley, Vice President of Economic and Workforce Development, is retiring just over a month before his 27th anniversary at the college. He oversees training of new employees at area industries, workers who need to learn new skills, apprentices, and some of the managers who supervise employees and operations in both blue and white-collar businesses. He also oversees continuing education and adult basic education, including courses at the correctional facility in Clarinda. Stanley started at Iowa Western in 1994 as Executive Director of Economic Development. He was in charge of administering the Federal Job Training Partnership Program of 1982, which was repealed in 1998, and the Iowa Industrial New Jobs Training Program and the Iowa Job Training Programs in the area. He also oversaw the Small Business Development Center. The workforce programs, ever since I started, there's just been declining funding, he said. Stanley's staff has diminished from almost 20 to just a handful. Along with his office and administrative staff, he has one full-time trainer and contracts with several others as needed. Sometimes we may not have a certain resource, so we might bring in someone from the Des Moines Area Community College or Western Iowa Technical Community College or Southwestern Community College. Sometimes the extra training talent we get is someone from the company. Training has continued, but with less reliance on state and federal funding, Stanley said. Years ago, the funding was there to support that, and now we have to cash flow all of our programs. The training has progressed from short-term projects to teach a specific skill to a small group of employees at a business to provide ongoing services, Stanley said. Now our relationship with our employers is more of a strategic partnership, and our training could last for years, he said. The relationships extend beyond training to strategic planning with company officials, he said. As far as economic development, working with companies considering building a plant or office in the area has changed too, Stanley said. It used to be mainly about the site, and the developer would just assume the labor force would be there, he said. Now the labor force is the number one issue by far. While it's not unusual for workers' skills to be somewhat different or lower than those needed at a new employer in the community, Stanley thinks the gap has gotten bigger. The skill sets needed are changing pretty rapidly, he said. Iowa needs more people to move into the state, but it also needs to fully utilize technology to increase productivity, Stanley said. As technology advances or there's greater modernization of facilities, typically that means greater productivity from workers and that means higher wages, he said. Stanley grew up in Shenandoah and got his interest in business from his dad, whom he described as an engineer and a savvy investor. Even though he was an engineer, he had a great head for business and certainly for finance, he said. He attended South Dakota State University for 3 years before graduating from Northwest Missouri State University. He earned an MBA at Drake University and saw himself becoming some kind of consultant. Stanley's first job was working on economic development for Watonwan County in St. James, Minnesota. The description sounded like a consulting job and he enjoyed it. I spent most of my time working with companies on strategy and business plans, he said. Stanley stayed in that position for 4 years before the opportunity opened up at Iowa Western. This job came up and I think I enjoyed it right from the start, he said. I think community colleges are a neat environment because you have a chance to do so many things. Stanley's looking forward to taking a break. Then he plans to start a business, Skyline Commercial Capital, LLC. I will promote financing to businesses of all types and from all sources using conventional and alternative financial sources, he said. I will also provide that for commercial real estate. I'm looking forward to doing this. I think this really kind of marries up what I think I can do well and what I really enjoy. Stanley and his brother once owned a restaurant franchise, and his wife Angela, a physical therapist, owned a practice for about 10 years that once included a group of 10 therapists, he said. The couple has three children, son Mitchell, who will graduate from the University of Nebraska at Omaha in December, daughter Erin, who will be a junior at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln this fall, and son Trey, a senior at Glenwood High School. And the second story is entitled Swan Song. Baumert reflects on 40 years with Jenny Edmondson. This article is accompanied by a portrait of Steve Baumert posing outside Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital, where he is president and CEO. He will mark today as the last day at the hospital as he prepares for retirement after 40 years with Jenny Edmondson. And here's the story. Today, Steve Baumert will walk into Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital one last time as president and CEO. It's a good time for me. I want to spend more time with my grandkids. My wife and I want to travel, he said, of retiring after 40 years with the hospital, and I think the organization is in a good spot for a transition, he added. Baumert came to the hospital in 1981 and worked his way up through a variety of administrative roles before taking over in 2007. My wife and family have been extremely supportive. In particular, my wife has been my rock. To be able to work with me through all of this, Baumert said, it's time to be able to spend more time with family, he said. Baumert has been married to his wife, Kathy, a retired speech-language pathologist who worked primarily in area school systems and agencies for 43 years. They have two children. Stephanie, 37, lives in Hudson in northeast Iowa with husband Scott and their three children, and Mark, who lives in Ankeny with his wife Morgan and two daughters. Baumert grew up in Howells, a village in northeast Nebraska between Norfolk and Fremont, where he played guard on the high school basketball team before playing collegiately at Nebraska Wesleyan in Lincoln, Nebraska. He then studied physical therapy at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. His love of sports drew him to physical therapy, while a personal experience also attracted him to the healthcare field. I had an uncle that had brain cancer when I was young. He died at an early age in his 30s. I had the opportunity to experience that, to see his hospitalizations, his decline, and his rehab that he received, Baumert said. Baumert's first job out of UNMC was at the Omaha Veterans Affairs Hospital, where he worked for 3 years as a physical therapist before taking the assistant director of physical therapy job at Jenny Edmondson in 1981. In 1986, Baumert became director of rehab and community services and later took on the role of vice president of operations in 1998. He was named vice president and chief operating officer at Jenny Ed in 2006 and took over as president and CEO a year later. During that time span, he earned an administrative master's degree at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. I gravitated toward more administrative activity, he said. I'm very thankful for the administration at Jenny for giving me the opportunity to grow and experience the administrative realm. I didn't have to move. I didn't have to go somewhere else. And what attracted me to stay at Jenny was we're a community hospital. We're big enough to do state-of-the-art medicine, but yet we're small enough to be a family, and Jenny's family is second to none. Baumert said his wife's encouragement was critical throughout his career, while also thanking his predecessors, Edward Lynn and David Holcomb, who he still has breakfast with each month, for their guidance. The three oversaw the hospital for a total of roughly 55 years. In announcing his impending retirement in February, the hospital noted Baumert has overseen a number of accomplishments at the hospital, including the expansion of women's health services, highlighted by the opening of the Jenny Edmondson Medical Plaza in June of 2020, followed in December by the completed expansion and renovation of the hospital's fifth floor to provide a new state-of-the-art home for the care of women and newborns. The new medical office building also opened in 2018. I'm excited over the last 5 years of how we've improved the look and feel of this campus, Baumert said. But I'm more excited by the strengthening of clinical programs we've been able to achieve. And Baumert has been in charge throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, from the early days of the unknown novel coronavirus to the depressing peaks in case numbers and deaths to now the continued effort to get as many vaccine shots in arms as possible. It was one where we became more knowledgeable of what we were dealing with as time went on. It was stressful for the entire organization. We had to make changes and adapt. I was extremely proud of the Jenny staff and the medical staff and how we banded together, how our Jenny family came together to meet the needs of this community and take great care of patients, and we took care of each other, he said, noting that as nurses and doctors dealt with crowded COVID wings, working their best to save lives, the work was stressful, not only at the hospital, but at home. We helped each other out, he said, of staff and the community as a whole, mentioning respite rooms for employees, meals provided by Edwards Auto Group, the Hospital Foundation, raising money to assist the effort, and more. I think the community worked together really well. Pottawatomie County Emergency Management and Public Health. One of the positives that's coming out of this pandemic is working together, he said. The legacy of Jenny Edmondson is a group of volunteers that wanted to take care of the community. I view this pandemic as a testament to this community. We carried on their legacy of caring. Baumert credited his ability to help lead the hospital in part to being able to pick the brains of his peers while also serving on community boards. In 2017 and 18, Baumert served as board chair for the Iowa Hospital Association. He served on the Council Bluffs Chamber of Commerce Board from 2006 to 13, serving as chairman during that time. He also has been a member of the American Hospital Association Region 6 Provider Board. I would like to think that with the help of my leadership, Jenny has improved the quality of care, access to care, and the programs and services to meet the needs of this community. My role representing Jenny in many community boards, I'd like to think, improved the quality of life in Council Bluffs. And I'd hope that with my leadership and work with the Iowa Hospital Association and the American Hospital Association helped improve health care across the state of Iowa in general. I felt the relationship with all of the other CEOs across Iowa really helped mentor me. We got into some great discussions, saw what other people are doing, heard what others are doing in their facility. Everyone was not competitive. They laid down their guard and helped each other out. I felt that relationship made me a stronger leader, which I think helped the Jenny organization. Baumert also said that Jenny Edmondson becoming a part of the Methodist Health System in 1994 helped the hospital and in turn the community, while also commending Methodist for maintaining a local Jenny Edmondson board. I'm proud of our board of directors. They've been a great resource for me to help guide this organization, he said. In announcing Baumert's retirement in February, Methodist Health Systems President and CEO Steve Gessner said Baumert has been an integral part of our organization for many years, and his strong leadership skills and contribution will be forever valued. He will be deeply missed, but he leaves behind an incredible legacy of dedicated service to our patients, employees, and the community, Gessner said. Baumert will be replaced by Dave Bird, who was named Senior Vice President of the Operations in May of 2020. I would describe myself as a passionate leader driven by the chance to make an impact on people's lives, Bird told the Nonpareil in June of that year. Where else but the healthcare industry can you do that? That's why I've stayed in this industry, he said. Baumert said Bird has interacted extremely well with employees and hospital staff. He fits in well with our culture, he said. The transition will be seamless because the organization and the medical staff know him. Bird will be the fourth CEO since 1996, which Baumert called unheard of in the industry. The new president and CEO takes over on Thursday. As for Baumert, it's time for family and travel. He's hopeful a trip to the Northeast to see the leaves turn is in the offing, along with an attempt to make a trip to Croatia that was canceled in 2020 as the pandemic hit. My wife has a long list of places that she wants to travel to, he said. I joked the other day, I think I'd get to go along. Continuing stories on the front page, TS Bank and 712 to provide assistance. Families and neighborhoods planning improvement projects may be able to get some help through a new program called AMP for Neighborhoods. Trainer-based TS Bank partnered with the 712 initiative to launch the program, which will provide funding for direct homeowner projects, neighborhood block initiatives, and down payment assistance, a press release from TS Bank stated. As lead sponsor, TS Bank donated $3,500 to the 712 initiative for the AMP program. Other sponsors include Back Hills Energy and Real Property Management, Deb and Pete Peterson. It's just a way of showing pride of ownership in your neighborhood or community, said Cheryl Garst, CEO of the 712 Initiative. We couldn't be more thrilled to partner with TS Bank on AMP, Garst said. A home investment is one of the biggest investments in a person's life and can have the greatest impact on their personal success and our community as a whole. We encourage all residents to dream and submit a nomination for themselves or for a fellow neighbor that could use some extra assistance. Eligible projects would include things like landscaping, siding, painting, fencing, driveways, sidewalks, windows, roofing, and exterior doors, according to the press release. The recipients selected will be awarded up to $5,000 to apply toward their project, the press release stated. The money might also be divided among multiple winners. We'll try to stretch it to two or three, depending on the applications, Garst said. We consider it a great honor to reinvest in our local communities, said Kelsey Stupfeld, TS Bank Director for Public Relations. We're excited to launch AMP and collaborate with local leaders, nonprofit organizations, and community members to help make an impact in our neighborhoods for years to come. For more information and an application, visit tsbank.com, scroll down to What's Trending, and click on Local Bank Partners with Nonprofit to provide neighborhood assistance. Then use the link on the description to go to the online application form. Applications are due August 15, 2021, and may be sent via email to marketing@tsbank.com or hand-delivered to TS Bank in Council Bluffs. Winners will be determined by TS Bank, the 712 Initiative, and the Selection Committee. Any questions can be directed to Kelsey Stupfeld at tsbg.com or 712-487-0334. And wrapping up the front page stories, fickle weather takes Iowa crops on a roller coaster. This is datelined out of Des Moines, written by Rod Beauchart of the Gazette's Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's notoriously volatile and fickle weather patterns caused some roller coaster effects for developing crops over the past week, state officials reported Monday. Farmers reported many crops benefited from much-needed rain, but more moisture is needed, especially in the northern two-thirds of the state, according to the latest crop report issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Agriculture Statistics Service. But there also were scattered reports of damaging hail and high winds throughout Iowa. An active weather pattern shifted into the Midwest last week, bringing several days of widespread and beneficial rainfalls, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig. The rain came just when moisture-stressed corn and soybeans needed it, he said. Unfortunately, severe thunderstorms caused crop damage in parts of western and central Iowa, as well as flash flooding across southeastern Iowa, said Naig, head of the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. The forecast shows additional chances of rain and milder temperatures are expected over next week. Weekly precipitation totals range from slightly more than 1/4 inch in Sheldon to 8.1 inches in Cedar Rapids over the past week. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 2.13 inches, almost double the weekly normal of 1.09 inches. Monday's report followed last week's updated assessment by the U.S. Drought Monitor that much of Iowa continued to face moderate to severe drought conditions, but timely and beneficial rains have at least stabilized crop conditions. About 44% of the state's reported severe drought, mostly in northern and central Iowa, with more than 90% of the state considered abnormally dry. The majority of Council Bluffs and southwest Iowa reported moderate drought conditions. Despite the volatile growing conditions, about 60% of Iowa's corn crop was rated in good to excellent condition in Monday's weekly crop progress and condition report. Also, soybean emergence was virtually complete with 19% of soybeans blooming 6 days ahead of the 5-year average, with some scattered reports of plants setting pods and 58% of the overall crop rated in good to excellent condition. While precipitation fell across Iowa this past week, Amounts received varied widely, with Northwest Iowa still reporting over two-thirds of topsoil moisture short to very short. In contrast, districts in the southern one-third of Iowa rated 60% or more of subsoil moisture adequate to surplus. Even with the beneficial rains, topsoil moisture levels were rated 12% very short, with 82% short to adequate and 6% surplus, while half of Iowa was rated short or very short of subsoil moisture. State climatologist Justin Glisson said several waves of showers and thunderstorms brought measurable rainfall statewide along the multiple days of severe weather. Parts of southern and northeast Iowa received heavy rain, which led to localized flash flooding, while portions of northwest Iowa continued to miss out on higher totals. On a related development, Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation Monday for Linn, Monroe, and Wapello counties in response to severe weather beginning June 24th and continuing. The governor's proclamation allows state resources to be utilized to respond to and recover from the effects of this severe weather and activates the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program for qualifying residents, along with disaster case management program for those three counties. The Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program provides grants of up to $5,000 for households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level for a family of three. Grants are available for home or car repairs, replacement of clothing or food, and temporary housing expenses. Original receipts are required for those seeking reimbursement for actual expenses related to storm recovery. Potential applicants have 45 days from the date of the proclamation to submit the claim. Turning to the inside of the paper, we see the face of the day is Sydney Tipton, and she's making sure to keep cool this summer and have plenty of fun while doing so. Tipton, 11, is a native of Council Bluffs, and she'll be a sixth grader at Lewis Central Middle School next fall. She says she's nervous to make the jump to middle school, but she's also excited about it. She'll get to take part with her peers coming up with her from Titan Hill Intermediate School. Enough about school, though, as Tipton says she's having a fun time in the early stages of her summer break. Tuesday afternoon, she was seen at the intersection of Bel Air and Renner Drives, just down the street from her old school, Kreft Primary, splashing around with other kids and cooling off during one of Council Bluffs Fire Department's twice-weekly hydrant parties. She said it's the first hydrant party for her this season, but she hopes to make it a few more over the next couple months. Tipton is a member of Girl Scout Troop 417, that's 40017, and the last time the nonpareil caught up with her, she was helping sort Girl Scout cookie orders for troops in Pottawatomie County and a few surrounding areas. Now, months later, she's looking forward to a week-long summer camp in Boone. She'll feel right at home as her sister Ava, 12, will be attending camp, and her oldest sister, Madison, will be working as a camp counselor. Tipton said she's looking forward to many activities, but the equestrian part of the camp is her absolute favorite. There's still a lot of summer left, and Tipton is going to make sure she doesn't waste even a second of it. UP works on a rail line in Bluffs. Union Pacific was busy working on the railroad at South 16th Street and 7th Avenue Tuesday. Workers apparently replaced a section of rails on one track at that location. Robin Tivsner, a UP spokeswoman, said it was just routine maintenance. Union Pacific is continuously inspecting, monitoring, and maintaining our track system, she said Tuesday. We have about 32,000 miles of mainline track across the western two-thirds of the country and about 400 track inspectors. The work that is being done in Council Bluffs is being done by a crew dedicated to inspecting and maintaining curved track. Tisver said UP expected to complete the work Tuesday and have the street open again today. The Iowa Restaurant Association is seeking nominations to recognize women in the hospitality industry. The Iowa Restaurant Association has opened up nominations for their third annual 40 Women to Watch in Hospitality Award. This award recognizes 40 women in Iowa's hospitality industry for their creativity, leadership, and contributions. Nominations can be made online at restaurantiowa.com and will be accepted until August 1 at 5 p.m. 61% of women have worked in the restaurant at some point in their lives, said Jessica Dunker, president and CEO of the Iowa Restaurant Association. We are excited to celebrate women influencing every aspect of food service by recognizing those who are doing great things and building lifelong careers, she said. From operations and human resource managers to servers, chefs, and owners, women are making a huge impact at every level, she added. Along with nominations for the 40 Women to Watch in Hospitality Award, the Iowa Restaurant Association has also opened nominations for the 2021 Celebrating Excellence Awards. For more information on those awards or to submit a nomination, visit restaurantiowa.com. Trouble in River City. A California resident has claims of holding Music Man history. This is Dateline Mason City. In 1967, California resident Robert T. DeNormandy, Jr. got a chance to perform as a guest musician with the Robin Hood Marching Band of Hollywood for that year's iteration of the Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena. Thai Minister of Foreign Affairs Thinot Koman was the Grand Marshal, and the hometown USC Trojans took on the Purdue Boilermakers, who won the Rose Bowl 14-13, courtesy of two rushing touchdowns from fullback Perry Williams. According to an article at the time from the Peotone Vedette out of Illinois, DeNormandy, who grew up in the Chicago suburbs, was a junior at the local Evergreen Park High School and had already received a number of musical honors and awards to that point in his life. Bob spent the past four summers at the Illinois Youth Summer Music Camp in Urbana and 3 years on the national stage bands at Bloomington, Indiana, the article reads. He has won superior ratings in state solo contests and as a first-chair baritone player with the Southwest Suburban Festival Concert. 54 years and 1,800 miles later, DeNormandy made it to Mason City, betting that all that musical knowledge and experience would pay off. But it hasn't. Not yet. Per DeNormandy, an agent for the Music Man Square said they had ways and means to raise the funds to cover the cost. And I said, that's great. So I'm really feeling anxious and excited and thinking, wow, what a great idea. This could be exhibiting in some museum. My baby's going to come home where it belongs. I'm getting psyched up for myself, DeNormandy recalled. From there, he said that a private investor in the Music Man Square got involved, who would work in conjunction with the board of directors to help pay for the euphonium and then donate it on exhibit, which the investor later confirmed with the Globe Gazette. That was the intent from day one, they said. At a certain point, the serial number on the euphonium became a sticking point. DeNormandy insists that the proper way to read the serial number on a Reynolds piece, such as his, 61064, is that the first two digits represent the year. The following digits then indicate the production number. That matters because if the 61 does indicate the year 1961, then the timeline of the instrument could fit when the movie came out. The Music Man came out in 1962. He said that folks from the Music Man Square saw the issue with the serial number differently, which Nick Whitehurst from the organization confirmed. The information we had been able to find with comparing the serial number provided and the maker, the horn itself, would have been dated after the movie was produced, Whitehurst said. According to him, the number issued raised a flag, as did the lack of documentation for the instrument and the ultimate inability to verify whether it was not the euphonium that was in fact screen used in The Music Man. Without having proper documentation, we weren't able to confirm it, and with the information we were able to find, the manufacturer didn't line up, Whitehurst said. Per Whitehurst, someone who does verification work for their work weighed in on the matter. But he chose not to disclose who the person was or what their specific credentials were. When asked why he chose not to disclose the expert in question, Whitehurst said, "I would not want to cause more of a stir than there already is." With that information, Whitehurst said that the Music Man Square decided not to go through with any deal, which the private investor followed suit on. DeNormandy said he felt blindsided by that decision. I felt damaged. I felt my integrity had been questioned, and I feel like I've been called a liar. And that, I feel, needs to be soothed over. I need to talk with this individual so he can personally see the horn and he can personally see the serial number. And with that, we're going to pause so that we can go to other items on our list of things to read today. We'll come back to this if we have time. You're listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First is Wayne L. Kreft. Wayne L. Kreft, aged 85, passed away June 28, 2021. He was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on June 19, 1936 to the late Ernest and Helen Clausen Kreft. Wayne graduated from the Wyota High School and served his country in the United States Army. He was a longtime tool and die maker. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his daughter, Melody. The first is Wayne L. Kreft. Wayne L. Kreft, aged 85, passed away June 28, 2021. He was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on June 19, 1936, to the late Ernest and Helen Clausen Kreft. Wayne graduated from Wyota High School and served his country in the United States Army. He was a longtime tool and die maker. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his daughter, Melanie. Wayne is survived by his wife of 60 years, Colleen Kreft, children Leanne, Tammy, Matthew, and Michael, two sisters, 10 grandchildren, and 27 great-grandchildren, as well as a host of other family and friends. Visitation is at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Thursday, July 1, 2021, from 5 to 7 p.m. Memorial service is at the funeral home on Friday at 1 p.m. The family will direct memorials in his honor to the City of McClellan and the Midlands Humane Society. Nancy Ann Schwerm Blum. Nancy Ann Schwerm Blum, age 61, of Bennington, Nebraska, passed away at her home on Sunday, June 27, 2021. A memorial service will be held on Friday, June 2nd at 3 p.m. at the Walnut Community Center in Walnut, Iowa. A visitation with family present will be held the night before, July 1, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Pauli Jones Funeral Home in Avoca, Iowa. Survivors include her husband, Jeff, her daughter, Allison, siblings, Cindy and Neil, and foreign exchange sister, Conchie Madsen of Cincinnati, Ohio, as well as family and many, many friends. Jim Bear Roach. A celebration of life for Jim Bear Roach, Saturday, July 3, 2021 at 11:30 a.m. at the Jensen Farm, 21888 Road L34, Underwood, Iowa. The family asks that you wear your favorite baseball team attire. There's lots of sports in today's paper. We'll begin with this. Trojans and Eagles start off hot in the WIC. IKM Manning 3, Riverside 1. A key second and third inning helped the Wolves defeat the Bulldogs on Monday night in the Western Iowa Conference Tournament's first game. Riverside plated a run in the top of the fifth in an attempt to make their run, but they just could not get the bats going as they were held to five hits. Senior Eddie Vleck and freshman Mason McCready each had two hits for the Bulldogs. McCready was also the player who scored the run. In the Tri-Center IKM Manning game, Tri-Center won 10-0. Tri-Center scored four runs within the first two innings, and while the Wolves forced the game to go to a sixth inning, the Trojans scored six runs to put the game away within six innings in Monday first round of the Western Iowa Conference Tournament. Junior Justice Weirs led TC with three hits and two RBIs, and senior Brett McGee added two more hits. Senior Leighton Nelson got the win on the mound for the Trojans after pitching for two and a third innings, allowing just one hit and striking out four batters. Notably, senior Mason Rochat pitched for three and two-thirds innings for the Trojans and struck out six batters while not allowing any hits. The Trojans will face Missouri Valley, who defeated Logan Magnolia in the quarterfinals 8-1 at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday in the WIC semifinals. And Underwood defeated AHSTW 9-0. Underwood plated 8 runs within the first 2 innings to take control and eventually defeat the Vikings for the 3rd time this season. The Eagles held the Vikes to just 1 hit for the whole game. Freshman Nick Denning was the one who got the hit for the single. Senior Colby Fink, junior Clayton Lewitt, and junior Easton Elledge all led the way with 2 hits for the Eagles. Freshman Jack Van Fossen led the team with 3 RBIs. Van Fossen also got the win on the mound after pitching for 5 innings and striking out 8 batters. Trainer defeated Audubon 8-6 on Tuesday in the other quarterfinal. In prep softball, Warriors stifle Lynx bats. Abraham Lincoln softball only managed 3 hits and 1 run against Sergeant Bluff Luton in Monday's road doubleheader, losing 2 games 12-0 and 13-1. The loss in the 6th in a row for the Lynx that have been playing with multiple injuries. We have 5 starters out, head coach Ryan Koth said, including both pitchers. They're going through a lot of adversity right now. The kids still got out and compete. New kids are getting opportunities to show what they can do. They're not backing down from anyone. SBL took an early lead in the first game, scoring 5 runs in the bottom of the second, adding three in the third and four in the fourth. Junior Emma O'Neill was responsible for the lone hit for AL in game 1. Sergeant Bluff Luton went 13 of 31 from the late with 11 RBIs. Neither team committed an error. Abraham Lincoln found success early in game 2 when freshman Jaden Hargrave singled and scored later in the inning. But Sergeant Bluff Luton scored 11 in the first, 1 in the second, and 1 in the third. O'Neill was responsible for the other hit. The Warriors went 10 of 17 from the plate in game 2. Abraham Lincoln softball drops to 12-15 with a pair of losses. AL also lost a pair of games to Sioux City Helan on Tuesday night. Turning now to prep baseball, Falcons fly by Rams in a doubleheader sweep. St. Alban baseball had no problem taking care of Glenwood in Monday night's doubleheader sweep, winning 12-2 and 12-1. All 9 players in the Falcons' batting order finished at least 1 hit. It took a moment for the bats to heat up in the first game with the 2 teams in a scoreless tie after the 2nd inning. The Falcons scored their first run in the top of the 3rd, sparking the offense. St. Albert added 5 in the 4th and 6 in the 5th to take a 12-run lead. The Rams added 2 in the 5th, but lost via run rule after the 3rd out. Senior Isaac Sherrill recorded 3 RBIs and had 1 double. Senior Cy Patterson had 2 hits, including 1 double with 4 RBIs. Sophomore Brendan Monahan went 2 for 4 with 2 RBIs. Junior Carter White recorded 2 hits, and senior Brett Klusman added 2. Senior Jeff Miller pitched all 5 innings, allowing 2 hits on 6 hits. Allowing 2 hits on 6 hits. I think maybe means 2 runs on 6 hits, while striking out 4 batters and walking none. The offense clicked immediately for the Falcons in game 2. St. Albert scored 2 runs in the first inning, 7 in the second, 1 in the 6th, and 2 in the 7th. Glenwood's lone run came in the 4th. Sophomore Colton Brennan went 3 for 4 with 1 double and 2 RBIs. Sherrill went 2 for 3 with 1 RBI. Patterson had 2 hits, including a double and an RBI. Monahan and freshman Jackson Leon each recorded 2 hits, and Lennon had 2 RBIs. Senior Eric's Matai and Klusman each had 2 RBIs as well. Matai also pitched all 7 innings. He allowed 1 unearned run on 4 hits while striking out 2 and walking 4. St. Albans softball also played Glenwood in a doubleheader on Monday, but lost both games, losing 6-0 and 10-0. In game 1, the Rams added 2 in the 1st, 2 in the 4th, 1 in the 5th, and 1 in the 6th. In game 2, Glenwood led 3-0 entering the top of the 4th, 5-0 entering the top of the 6th, and scored 5 runs in the 6th to win via the mercy rule. Highlights include freshman Sophie Sheffield making a clutch catch to end the inning in the 3rd inning. no sets were available for the Saints games. And one more prep baseball story. Hetzel gets his first career hit. Bradley Hetzel became the first eighth grader in Lewis Central baseball program history to record a hit in a varsity game on Monday night when the Titans swept Creston in a road doubleheader. LC won the first game 15-16 and the second 11-0. It's nice to get a doubleheader sweep, head coach Jim Waters said. Doubleheaders have not been kind to us in the past couple of weeks. It's nice to change the outcome, he added. The wins were nice, but Hetzel's hit was a highlight for sure. Waters said the hit was a sign of things to come from Hetzel and other young players. Right away, I knew that was history in the making, Waters said. As a coaching staff, we were very elated about that because we think Brady has a really bright future with us. It's great to have him in our program since he graduated from the eighth grade. Not only Brady, but we have very talented eighth graders in the program. We think it's going to pay benefits to us down the road. The Titans took an early lead in Game 1, scoring 3 in the top of the first and extending their lead to 10 in the top of the second. The Panthers cut the deficit to 10-2 in the bottom of the second and trailed by 7 after 4 full innings. LC extended its lead to 12-3 in the top of the fifth, and both teams scored 3 runs in the seventh. Junior Aaron Harrington led the Titans on offense in Game 1. We went 4-for-4 with a single, double, and 2 home runs for 6 total RBIs. Sophomore Casey Clare also hit a grand slam. In Game 2, LC took an early lead, scoring 4 in the top of the first, and added 1 in the third, 3 in the fourth, 1 in the fifth, and 2 in the seventh. Hetzel's hit came in Game 2. Junior J.C. Dermody led the Titans with 4 RBIs in Game 2. Clare and Harrington each had 2 hits. Dermody started on the mound in Game 1 for LC. He pitched 3 innings, allowing 2 runs on no hits, while walking 4 batters and striking out 6. He picked up the win for his effort. Freshman Luke Woltman pitched 4 innings. He allowed 4 runs on 6 hits while taking 1 and striking out 3. It says talking 1, but I believe that means walking 1. He allowed 4 runs on 6 hits while walking 1 and striking out 3. Senior Kale Melkskite, I hope I pronounced that correctly, started the second game. He pitched 4 innings and allowed no runs on 2 hits while striking out 4 and walking 1. Junior Trenton Johnette pitched 3 innings, allowing 2 hits while walking 1 batter and striking out 4. Lewis Central is 17-6 after the pair of wins and is in action next at 7:30 p.m. today at Sioux City East. And taking a look at college basketball, the Hawkeyes' Ash is hoping for meaningful minutes. Austin Ash was in the NCAA's transfer portal for perhaps a month, maybe not even that long. After 4 years of being a valued member of the scout team for the University of Iowa basketball team, he's decided to try and finish his college career somewhere as the main man. He really liked the coaching staff at Loras College and also had conversations with people at Coe College and a few NCAA Division II programs. My thing was that if I wasn't going to come back, I was going to go somewhere that I was going to play 35 minutes a game and be the guy that got some shots, Ash said. Then in the final days of April, he got the phone call that fully crystallized his decision. Iowa coach Fran McCafferty invited him to return to the Iowa program for one more season, this time as a scholarship athlete instead of a walk-on. It was kind of a no-brainer for me, Ash said, conceding that it was slightly odd to be coming back after going through senior day ceremonies late last season. It never felt like I was really totally out the door, though, because it wasn't too long afterwards, he added. I'm just really excited and to get back to work with these guys. Ash admitted Tuesday that he's not entirely sure what his role will be on the court next season. He's not going to play 35 minutes a game. He won't start. But it's not out of the question that he could end up making some sort of major contribution. I'm still trying to figure that out, Ash said. I'm just going to try to take advantage of whatever opportunity I get, whether that's coming in and knocking down a big shot or throwing the extra pass or making hustle plays on the court. The 6'3", 179-pound Ash has played in only 26 games over the past 3 seasons, almost entirely in mop-up situations at the end of lopsided games. He has scored a grand total of 42 points. Subscribe today and support local journalism. But it looks as though the Hawkeyes are going to need perimeter shooting help, and that's clearly what Ash does best. Iowa set a school record last season by making 301 three-point field goals, but more than half of those were by Joe Weiskamp, Luke Garza, and C.J. Frederick, all of whom shot 44% or better from behind the arc, and all of whom are now gone. Ash frequently has boasted that he would take himself over anyone, including Iowa career three-point leader Jordan Bohannon, in the long-distance shooting contest. He shot 43.24% from three-point range and scored 1,092 points at Mount Vernon High School. Of the 14 field goals he has made at Iowa, 11 have been three-pointers. He thinks that skill could lead him to getting some meaningful minutes. That's the goal. That's what I'm working toward, Ash said. Coach McCafferty talked to me about it. We lost a huge number of threes from our last year when you look at Luca, CJ, Joe, and a lot of great shooters. That's one thing I can do, is knock down the threes. With the way we play, we take a lot of threes a game, so I'm just going to try to take advantage of the opportunity, and if I have the shots, knock them down. Regardless of his role, Ash thinks he's going to enjoy the coming season with what is admittedly a much younger core of players. It's a fun group, he said. Obviously, when you lose a player like Luke Garza, a National Player of the Year, there's some holes, but I think we're going to be a fast team, a different team, with a lot of guys who are stepping up this summer and making big improvements for over last year. Being one of the elder statesmen for that group could be good training for what Ash plans to do once his playing career is over. Once I'm done playing, whether it's this year or next year, I definitely want to get into coaching, whether it's as a grad assistant somewhere or as an assistant at a Division II or III school, and just work my way up, he said. That's definitely my main option right now. I'm kind of keeping a lot of windows open, but I definitely want to stay around the game of basketball for as long as I can. Top Oklahoma quarterback prospect commits to the Hawkeyes. University of Iowa coaches typically take just one quarterback in each of its football recruiting classes, and for the Hawkeyes' 2022 recruiting class, that spot belongs to the top prep quarterback prospect in Oklahoma. Carson May, a 6'5", 210-pound pro-style quarterback from Jones, Oklahoma, accepted an Iowa scholarship offer one day after it was offered, verbally committing to the Hawkeyes program on Tuesday. May has displayed a prolific arm as a two-year starter for Jones High School, located just northeast of Oklahoma City. He completed 219 of 364 passes for 3,007 yards in 12 games last fall and rushed for an additional 650 yards while leading a 9-3 team to the third round of the Oklahoma Class 2A playoffs. He accounted for 40 touchdowns, 26 through the air. May also quarterbacked Jones to the second round of the Class 2A playoffs in 2019 during a 10-2 season. Over the past two seasons, May has passed for 5,324 yards while completing 388 of 622 passes. He's thrown 48 touchdown passes and has been intercepted 12 times. He has rushed for 900 yards as well during his 2 years as a starter for Jones, where May is also a standout on the basketball court. In making his choice public on Twitter, May thanked his family and his coaches at Jones High School for believing in me ever since I was a little kid, using his words. I'm really blessed to have great friends that are there for me through thick and thin. Special thanks to Coach O'Keefe and Coach Ferens for believing in an Oklahoma kid and the opportunity to play at a place like Iowa. And he wrapped up his Twitter feed by saying, "Committed, go Hawkeyes." May visited Iowa in mid-June and ultimately selected the Hawkeyes over offers from Old Dominion and Western Michigan. He also was seeing recruiting interest from Houston, Iowa State, Kansas State, Memphis, Oklahoma State, and TCU. Ranked by Rivals and 247 Sports as a three-star recruit on a five-star scale and as the top quarterback prospect in Oklahoma high schools in the class of 2022, May is the sixth player to verbally announce intentions to sign with the Hawkeyes in December. Okay, let's go back to our story about the Music Man and the double-belled euphonium. You'll recall we're on a verification quest. A lot of companies did their serial numbers sequentially. The 61 and 64 don't mean anything as far as a date. It doesn't reflect anything with dates, said Deborah Reeves, a curator of education at the National Music Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota. According to her, the best approach is to try to confirm a number from a serial number list. The website ContemporaryCorner.com contains a whole host of serial numbers and engraving info on instruments such as the trumpet, the flugelhorn, and the euphonium. On a page for Reynolds serial numbers, there is a list that runs from 1936 through July of 1979, when production ceased. In the entry for 1961, it's noted that, quoting here, most instruments between serial number 60,000 to 79,000 bear the RMC shield corresponding to the 1961-1963 periods that Richard Music owned Reynolds. Per Contemporary Corner, the F.A. Reynolds Company became a wholly owned subsidiary of the newly formed Richards Music Corporation in 1961. As a division of Richards Music, Reynolds became part of the Round Table of Musical Craftsmen at RMC, along with the Martin Band Instrument Company, E.K. Blessing, and Flatjack's Drums, all owned by Richard Music Corporation. Instruments produced by these companies during the Richards era all bear an RMC Shield logo, the Contemporary Corner post on Reynolds history stated. In 1962, Contemporary Corner notes that Richard Music also sponsored the Music Man Contest for individual musicians between the ages of 8 and 18, with national, regional, and local award winners. Music Man branded Emperor trumpets, cornets, and trombones were produced in conjunction with that contest. While there is not a shield in the most literal sense on de Normandie's instrument, there is a signature for Reynolds and an RMC, and the serial number on his instrument is 61064. Merlin Grady, who has done instruments for decades, wrote in an email that the youth looks legit, especially with the engraving. Over the phone, when asked about the engraving on de Normandie's instrument not being a carbon copy of other engravings for Reynolds instruments, Grady said that it wasn't uncommon for instrument manufacturers to do engravings by freehand. Kahn had an in-house engraver, and I'm presuming that's the way with all the old ones, Grady said. The author of the Reynolds Serial Numbers page on the Contemporary website does take care to note, I am not aware of any surviving official serial number records for Reynolds brass instruments. To add to that, Reeves pointed out that the serial number lists are terribly inaccurate, and that serial numbers are a guarded secret as far as a company is concerned. Margaret Banks, Reeves' colleague and associate director, senior curator of musical instruments at the National Music Museum, was more direct in her assessment of de Normandie's euphonium after seeing photos of it. In my opinion, this double bell euphonium was most likely one of the instruments used in filming The Music Man, she wrote in an email. Her reasoning: the National Music Museum has a flute, NMM101104, from the film, engraved with "Made by RMC for the filming of Meredith Willson's Music Man" by Warner Brothers. Banks said that when museum officials conducted research on that flute, they found that 211 instruments were provided by RMC's subsidiaries for use in the movie, which was produced in 1961 and released in 1962. The manufacturer of our flute, likely made in 1960, is attributed to the Martin Band Instrument Company, a subsidiary of RMC, and a subcontractor for the Pedler Company, Elkhart, Indiana, she wrote. Laura Schissel, who is from New Hampton and works as a senior musicologist for the Library of Congress, was less definitive about the euphonium. According to some of my euphonium friends, 6 double bell euphoniums were made for the filming of The Music Man. I suppose this could be one of them, he replied in an email. Behind the matter of the serial numbers for de Normandie's euphonium, the asking price and when he wanted the deal done became complicating factors as well. We had asked why or how the $11,000 price tag was arrived at, and the gentleman had told us that that was confidential, Whitehurst said. The private investor spoke to The Pacing. Some of what raised red flags for Music Man Square investors was the need for expediency, they said. Outside the realm of music, a search for Robert DeNormandy Jr. on Google turns up a fraud case where a Robert T. DeNormandy, then aged 66, received 5 years probation in 2016 for a forgery of a $356,000 check. Per the Marysville Appeal Democrat, which covers the counties of Sutter and Yuba near Sacramento, DeNormandy entered a U.S. bank and deposited the check into the account of his business, DeNormandy Consulting Limited. Multiple posts on DeNormandy's Facebook reference Yuba City as recently as 2021. The Appeal Democrat article includes an explanation from DeNormandy about why things unfolded the way they did. DeNormandy, according to the probation report, claimed he needed money to pay a ransom for his girlfriend, who had been kidnapped in the Philippines, reporter Harold Kruger wrote. Through Friday afternoon, DeNormandy has not responded to follow-up requests from the Globe-Gazette via email, Facebook Messenger, and phone call to chat about the case. There's no indication as of yet whether DeNormandy remains in the Midwest or whether he's made it to Florida, where he said he wanted to relocate after he gets a deal done on the euphonium, which travels with him in the Ford Explorer, along with a number of other personal effects. So for now, it seems he has not made it to his intended home, and neither has the instrument. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. I'm your reader, Twyla Glenn. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.